Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Hey, Jim.
Yeah, this is the most hilarious part of the whole podcast right here.
Well, this week on Physics Frontiers, we're going to talk about a paper that you came across by, let me see if I get this name right, Sotoriou and Feyeroni. It's called FR Theories of Gravity.
And so what's an FR Theory of Gravity? Did you figure that out?
Yes, I've got that much figured out. It's a modification of general relativity, where the theorists took a look at general relativity, and apparently this started way back in 1919 and 1923 by Weyl and Eddington looked at this. And they said that, well, maybe you can take the Ricci curvature scalar and generalize it so that you can look at all classes of answers, of solutions, of functions for the Ricci curvature scalar, rather than just keeping it as you have it in general relativity. And what would the implications of that be? I'm not entirely sure why the Ricci curvature scalar jumps out of the Einstein field equation as the factor to modify. Did you get a sense of that?
There was a section all about that, but I don't think the reason is physical. I think it's mathematical. So it's easy to handle. It's easy to make sort of toy theories if you just modify the Ricci scalar and not something like with the Ricci tensor. So he actually proposes that question, why not, you know, modify the Ricci tensor? And then he ignores it.
I think because he said that it just gets so hairy and complicated when you get into the mechanics that you open up a whole Pandora's box of mathematical complications.
Yeah, but that's the reason why they were working on that.
Oh, yeah. And the other terms in the equation, those are all tensors, right? So this was really the only factor that you could modify without opening up a whole hairball of issues.
I think so, yeah. But you have to remember that Ricci scalar is just a convolution of two tensors, right? It's like multiplying two tensors together and then taking the trace. And those are the Ricci tensor and the metric. It's kind of like that. It's not exactly like that. But it still has all that in there. All that stuff's still in that change. Again, I'm not completely sure why that jumps out that way. Because, I mean, it is a scalar, but it's based on these other tensors. And when you're doing the action, right, when you're minimizing the action to figure out what the equations of motion are, when you do that, you're modifying one of those components at that time, and that's the metric. I think in all of these FR theories that he's going to talk about, the idea is you're modifying the metric, you're sort of slowly varying the metric with mathematics in such a way that you get the minimization of this action, and that's what's going to actually give you, in the presence of matter, the curvature of space-time.
Okay, well, let's start by talking about the motivations for this, because it seemed like it was just an area of theoretical interest for a long time, but then we came up with observations that really seemed to call into question the validity of general relativity at large scales.
I think prior to that, prior to what you're thinking about, which I think are the contemporary issues, there are real theoretical issues there. And that,
like inflation.
Well, inflation is one of the contemporary issues, the more physically motivated ones. The big issue that started in the 1960s was trying to fold gravity into quantum theory. And it turns out that general relativity is not renormalizable. That is, if there's a singularity in it, you can't just change scales until it goes away. And that means that it's not quantizable. So you can't quantize general relativity. And they actually figured that out in the 60s. But they did figure out that if you have a higher order curvature, that is, if instead of your action being dependent on that Ricci scalar, it's actually dependent on some function of that Ricci scalar, which could be the dependent on the cube, it could be inversely proportional to the Ricci tensor, it could be anything like that. If it has something like that, it could be renormalizable. I don't think he went through exactly what the conditions were for making these things renormalizable, but apparently the higher order curvature does that, although it also produces additional invariants that we don't really know or understand. Then I think we get into the things you wanted to talk about, which are more experimentally motivated, or it's not really experimental, it's
observationally motivated,
and that's where you get into things like, you know, inflation and so forth.
I think he may have mentioned something about there had to be a scalar field associated with gravity if you were going to renormalize it.
Well, he was saying that there has to be a scalar field associated with gravity if you're going to have inflation.
That's right. And I guess now dark energy too, right? That looks pretty much like a scalar effect.
and dark energy, if it's got anything to do with the cosmological constant, it turns out, and dark energy does, then it has to be a scalar field. So that cosmological constant isn't really a constant that you normally think of like a number. It's a constant field. It's not of scale. It's a constant scalar field. A scalar field just means at every point in space, there's a number associated with it, sort of like the potential. Anything where you put in that cosmological constant, all of a sudden you have an additional scalar field on top of the gravitational field, on top of what they're going to call something like the mass field, right, which is just the mass distribution in space, right? Where are things in space?
Well, that's what I found really exciting when I started reading the paper, was that I'd always understood it that Einstein had added the cosmological constant to create a steady state universe where you've got gravity always being a positive attractive force, and so he added that term to create a steady state. And then I saw in this paper that a cosmological constant like term naturally arises from some of these FR theories of gravity, and that seemed exciting. It was like, oh wait, well maybe there was a kind of, you know, a higher mathematical justification for that Einstein didn't even know about.
Yeah, I mean, when you start looking at this, it looks like there are a lot of good reasons for it on top of the other things. But, I mean, in the end, or it's not really in the end. I mean, right at the beginning of this paper, he starts talking about it. And he says, you know what this is really best for? It's best for playing it around with gravitational theory. You know, these higher order terms that they're putting in here, and it turns out for various reasons that it doesn't have to be just a single term. It can be 1 over r plus r or something like that.
Yeah, it can be a really complex function.
These higher order terms are just in there to play with. There's no physical reason why you'd choose this one or that one or the other. It's just, you know, playing around with it, see what you can make gravity do, which is okay because, you know, you could end up reproducing the sorts of things that are really there and actually figure out something interesting about what's going on. But, you know, this is, say, one step above numerology in, you know, scientific terms.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of superstring theory in the sense that there's so many solutions, there's so many ways to go about it that it's a great mathematical playground, but there's not really a strong physical motivation for choosing one over the other, unless you just stumble upon the solution which accurately describes reality.
Yeah, I mean, you could end up making your Balmer series, right? You could end up with something like that where you just take the mathematics and you sort of fit it to the world, and then you get something that actually works, but you don't have a better idea about why it is, right? The Balmer series didn't make any sense at all until Bohr came up with his model of the atom. And if you get any positive results out of something like this, that's probably all you're going to get, is here's something that we have to figure out the reason for, right? Which isn't bad, but it's not, you know, the highest sort of calling in science.
Well, and we're also stuck with these observations now, you know, and we've got MOND, the modified Newtonian gravity, making efforts to explain dark matter and the flat rotation curves of the galaxies. And that's always kind of a disparaging way to approach the problem, because you know that Newtonian gravity isn't right. So modifying it is just seems like a bad patch on a complex problem. But here, this is a class of modifications to general relativity instead. And it seems like, well, maybe we'll actually hit something which is physically significant.
Yeah, there's something interesting later on dealing with that. So, I mean, eventually he goes in and he tries to show how some of these things can be equivalent to the Bronze-Dickey formalism or theory for gravity, which is, I guess, one of the more popular alternative gravities. One of the reasons for that popularity of the Bronze-Dickey theory is that in sort of the Newtonian limit, it creates a sort of repulsive gravitational field that has something to do with the interaction of the Higgs boson with other things. So it's fairly interesting that you end up with something like that.
Yeah, that was intriguing that they were like, well, we've got a scalar field here, and we just discovered this, that the Higgs boson's real, and that's a scalar field. So maybe there's a direct relation, and we could tie them together.
Oh, is that something he was talking about in the paper? Because I didn't get that from the paper. I got that from looking stuff up about the Bronze-Dickey formulation.
Yeah, he does mention that.
Okay. I was just interested in, why does he spend an entire section trying to show how this thing is related to the Bronze-Dickey formalism? And then I looked into why that was so interesting, and it just turned out that it was because it had this sort of implication for particle physics. Quickly, no, it doesn't have anything in here with the name of that guy that whose name I forgot to write down.
Well, maybe we can put that in the show notes so we can do some further looking at that.
Oh, it's Yukawa.
Oh, the Yukawa potential, yeah.
Yeah, it's the Yukawa potential that comes out of the Bronze Dickey.
Now, that name is familiar. I remember the Yukawa potential from nuclear physics. Is that the same guy, I guess, huh?
Here I have Yukawa term. But yeah, I think it's probably the same guy. So apparently this goes down to something from that Yukawa term, and maybe it's Yukawa potential. It's just that's the classical limit of the Bronze Dickey theory. So that's part of the reason I think he talks about this Bronze Dickey formalism being interesting to particle theorists, even though the Bronze Dickey formalism he claims is not interesting to relativists, because the Bronze Dickey theory isn't very geometrically interesting, even though it's equivalent to one of these FR theories of gravity.
Yeah, I get the impression that the FR theories of gravity are like the entire general case, and the Bronze Dickey theories are sort of a subset of this approach.
I think a subset of the Bronze Dickey theories are equivalent to a subset of these FR theories.
Oh, okay, so that's how the overlap works.
Yeah, I think it's an overlap. I don't think one is a member of the other. So the Bronze Dickey requires that this FR function, right, that this higher order function of the Ricci tensor that you put into the action, it requires the second derivative of that is zero. So basically, that is flat in the Ricci tensor at whatever the Ricci tensor is. I shouldn't say flat. I should say it's straight. So it could be continuously increasing. Like if you increased the Ricci tensor a little bit, it would always be the same amount, or that function is a straight line. That doesn't mean that it can't wiggle around farther away from there, but at that particular point, it's straight. It's just a mathematical condition. So if you have that, then you can have some overlap with the Bronze Dickey formalism. But it looks like, and I'm not sure how true this is, that only happens at particular values of this coupling constant that's in the Bronze Dickey formalism. And in this case, what he said was those were when that coupling constant is zero and when that coupling constant is -3/2. That's where the overlap is. Now, there might be more overlap, but that's all the overlap that he pointed out in this particular paper.
And it says that there's like three different formalisms for the FR theories of gravity. I think he said that there's a second order or a metric formalism. And then there's a first-order formalism called the Palatini formalism. And apparently that one has independent metric variables and the independent connection.
Yeah, he's got these three different formalisms that he uses with this FR function. So what happens is this FR function gets put into what's called the action, and then there's a minimization principle. Basically, the action is a single number that comes from integrating over the entirety of space-time, basically. And that number has to be minimized. And you do that with variational principles. The general idea of a variational principle is if you have, say, a light ray, right? If you're tracing a light ray going through two different media, right? What you do is you set up a variational principle to try to figure out what the path of that light ray was going from one point to another point, because you know where you're shining it and you know where it hits the wall, let's say. And you want to figure out what the actual path is. This is something that might happen with a laser. If you're in a non-dispersive medium with a laser, you can't see it. All you know is where it starts and where it ends, right? Can't really see the path. You might want to figure that out, let's say. So what you do is you just integrate over the amount of time it takes to get to those spots. And in this case, you're using the principle of least time rather than the principle of least action. And you just integrate over those paths to figure out how long it would take. And then, bam, you end up with that minimal path. And this is also how you can figure out how, say, a mirage works, is by looking at the least time path from the sky to your eye. And it turns out that if it's really hot, then the least time path is for the light is not to go directly from the sky to your eye. It's to get down low towards the ground and then twist back up towards your eye.
Hmm.
Okay, so it's really sneaky that way. That light crap. So the principle of least action is one of these classical variational principles. Things have to follow the...
Is that tied in with the idea of free fall in the null geodesic?
I think this is how they'd figure that out. You know, I think it's the same sort of idea. I mean, the amount of time it's been since I actually took a class on this has been very, very long.
Yeah, but you're way ahead of me because you've studied this stuff. I look at the Christoffel symbols and the tensors and I'm like, oh, shit.
You're not supposed to admit those sorts of things on the air.
Oh, sorry.
You know, you had everybody fooled for the first 8 episodes. So anyways, what they're trying to do is they've got this principle of least action and they've got an action, which is basically the integral of, you know, basically the trace of G times the Ricci scalar, or in this case, times the function of the Ricci scalar. And they actually add in a second action for the mass, which is basically the amount of action that's there because of all of the stuff in the universe, right? Every massive particle in the universe is sort of in that other term, the mass action is what he's calling it here. So what you're doing is you're varying these things. So when I was talking about light, I was varying the path of the light. For each one of these different formulations, what they're doing is they're varying different things. And the things that they're varying depend on the formulation. All of them include the metric. So when he's just talking about the metric formalism for the FR gravity, all that's changing is the metric. Yeah, it's basically the way you're measuring things at a particular point in space. This is a tensor field. It's a second rank tensor associated with every point in space, kind of like a matrix associated with every point in space. And they're just varying that mathematically to get some function that describes the dynamics of particles in that region with that mass distribution. You put that in there, you get that minimal metric, then you have your equation of motion for small particles.
Right. Well, one of the things that surprised me about the metric formalism was that he said that the effective energy density is positive definite and none of the energy conditions hold. That really caught me off guard. I thought that the energy conditions, at least they seem to be assumed to be a fact. Seems like in this extension that those energy conditions aren't prohibitive.
So as far as this is concerned, all they're looking for are what actually happens. Now, depending on your mass distributions, you could end up with different sort of metrics that may or may not be physically possible, especially considering you don't have a real reason for playing around with these. You can definitely screw things up by just throwing in this extra term. So I'm not really sure about that. I think when you have some of these things, if you ended up with a situation where it really didn't have that issue, or if you ended up with a situation where you really had strange things, people might not be happy with it. But I think I've seen somewhere in this paper where he's talking about at least regions where the energy is not positive definite.
Well, I guess if you look at even at the dark energy concept, that if you've got an accelerating universe, where's that energy coming from? Is there still conservation of energy at a global scale if you've got something like cosmic acceleration going on?
I've never really been sure about what happens with dark energy, what it really, really means. I mean, it really should not be adding energy into the universe. Ideally, it wouldn't. I'm not really sure whether or not it does or does not in the formulations that they have for it. It looks like it should, but I can't be sure because I don't know enough about it.
Well, yeah, I don't think anybody does. That's one of the reasons why we're looking at these alternatives, right? Is, you know, we're kind of at an impasse observationally, and we need to figure out a good theory that'll predict all this without looking ad hoc. And I guess that's the problem with dark energy. The lambda cold dark matter model and the cosmological constant model is that these seem like just they're patches.
Well, that's what they are, right? I mean, that's really what they are. You know we need something else happening, so let's invent a number for it, but we don't really have a physical reason for that other than we know that there's something happening. It's a patch, right? It's just a placeholder until they can figure out some real physics behind it.
Yeah, that's why I really like this concept. There's no physical reason. We can say that there's no reason to take a look at these FR models, but by the same token, there's not really any reason to exclude them either.
Yeah, there's no reason to exclude a lot of these things. With the way that they put this together, you can probably end up with lots of different situations, some of which are perfectly valid, and some of which are not. And you're stuck trying to figure out ways to sort through the infinite number of different theories that this FR thing actually puts out. Because it's an infinite number of theories, basically. So it's a whole category of theories. And that makes life a little bit difficult.
Yeah, later on he tries to constrain them by saying, well, these are the things that's got to fit, right? It's got to be able to make the same predictions in the weak field limit that Newtonian gravity and Einstein's gravity predicts. It's got to have, I think there's a whole list. Oh, you want it to be able to conform to the early cosmological inflation, the inflationary epoch of the universe when it was first born. It's got to have a radiation era. And then there's got to be a matter-dominated era, and you want to have a nice, smooth transition between them. And then it's also got to predict this accelerated epoch after that, because the universe did a weird thing. It seems like it expanded very quickly in the beginning in a radiation-dominated era, and there's got to be Big Bang nucleosynthesis taking place as it cools down and enters the matter era. And in the matter era, actually, the cosmos decelerates, and then all of the matter congeals and creates stars and galaxies, and that's got to last a certain period of time. And then then it starts to speed up again in the present era, where we're starting to accelerate faster and faster away, and then it's got to make some kind of prediction about where that's all going. So it's not easy to find a function which will make all of that happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, they don't really do it either, right? So,
yeah.
So, I mean, it's nice that they're looking at something like this. At least it's an attempt to get something that's pretty new in there that can actually explain things for a little while. So that was the first one, right? That was the FR theory. And like we said, that was just varied the metric. The second one was the Palatini version.
Yeah.
So the Palatini version, which was actually from Einstein, apparently, was where you're not just varying the metric, you're also varying the connection, right? Which is basically varying the derivatives, how the derivatives are taken, what the direction of absolute parallelism is, or something like that. I guess that's the physical way to talk about it. The physical way to talk about it is what does it mean to be parallel in this metric? You know, you could just say we're just going to leave all these derivatives alone and they're just going to be whatever they are. Or you can say, I'm going to let the equations tell me what parallel means. If I have these two things go off and never touch each other, what does that mean? And that's basically what they do, is they define this thing called a connection, which is a standard sort of symbol.
Is that a Christoffel symbol? What is that? I don't know the name of that.
Well, I think the thing is that it is equal to a Christoffel symbol if you don't let it vary.
Okay.
I've seen the gamma formulation before, but if you look at this in the paper, this connection, when this connection is equal to the Christoffel symbols itself, then you have the metric theory of gravity. When you allow it to vary so that it's a little bit different from the Christoffel symbols, then you end up with the Palatini version. That's what defines the parallel transport in this system. And you're just letting the action minimization do that. And I guess that makes it a little bit easier to actually do the minimization. That's why you end up with a first order theory instead of a second order theory. So I think that first order and second order are the order of the variations, right? So you can do variations to different orders, just like you can do derivatives to separate orders.
Right, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And so I guess if you have two things that you're varying, you just vary both of those to first order rather than varying the one thing to second order. That's actually fairly interesting in itself. And they end up with some strange things happening, right? You know, you start modifying the stress energy tensor. You have a modified source of gravity, for example. The FR proportional to R squared is very strange because that's conformally invariant matter so that T is equal to zero, so that the stress energy tensor is equal to zero, or maybe it's traces because I'm looking at my notes.
And that's the case where you get GR with a cosmological constant, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things he's saying is that what happens is this change that you're putting into the derivatives introduces a scalar field that is similar to the cosmological constant.
And a modified coupling constant, G over F, right?
Yeah, and you end up with that G over F prime, G over the first derivative of the function, the FR, with respect to the Ricci tensor. So it's...
Oh, that's what that is, okay.
So that's your effective gravitational constant at any particular spot. Again, that's actually interesting at the Bronze-Dickey thing, because the whole point of that whole theory was to have a varying gravitational constant from point to point in space. That's why they created that theory.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that until today either. But, I mean, that's one of the, again, you know, that book that I want to get to after the Paradoxes book, with the theory and experiment in gravitational physics or whatever it was, that keeps coming up in this paper. And so, you know, while I was reading this, I was flipping through that book as well and finding out all sorts of weird things.
Oh, cool.
That effective gravitational coupling, that effective G, actually shows up just in the metric formalism. And you end up having the same thing over and over and over again in all of them. That's true of all of these FR theories, is that, yeah, the gravitational coupling constant G changes in all of these because you're using that modified action.
I wonder if there's any way to test that. Has anybody tried to observe that? Is there any way to measure that?
Since in this case, this is still a universal constant, so there isn't really a way to tell. You still just get this number. I think there's somewhere in here where it's going to talk about fluctuations. I think that's actually in part C. Yeah, that's something for part C, where they talk a little bit about that.
Oh, there was also the third one, the metric affine formalism.
Before that, you're right here, the Palatini does give a cosmological constant, which is like R0 over 4. So it's a Ricci tensor divided by 4 ends up being a cosmological constant.
So it inverts to a quarter with a quarter of the power.
So that, yeah, that's interesting. And the next one is the weird one.
Yeah.
So it's a metric affine theory. And in that case, you need this weird hypermomentum, which is a third rank tensor. So it's like, instead of a 4x4 matrix, it's a 4x4x4 matrix. So it's like this big cube of a matrix, right? And that matrix for this hypermomentum has something to do with a functional derivative of the mass action with respect to the connection.
And what I found interesting in that, he said that it introduces new phenomenology. Things like torsion become relevant. And he said that since particles have spin, then torsion would be applicable physically. So I guess torsion would have some kind of influence on the curvature, right?
Yeah, the way he was talking about it, as I recall, there was a torsion in the action. Was that correct?
I think so.
No, it can't be, because the action is a number. And you got that torsion.
Doesn't it modify the action?
Yes, it does. The reason why I'm... So the torsion ends up being product of an asymmetry in the connection, right? In what it means to be parallel.
Okay.
And basically that asymmetry means that if you switch directions in this connection, so if you're looking at how much something is moving in X versus something moving in Y, if you switch how much something moves in X when you push it in the direction Y, and instead you look at how much something moves in the direction Y when you push it in X, that number is going to be different for both of those cases. So there's an asymmetry there. That's what's creating the torsion.
Interesting. It's like a chirality almost, isn't it?
Something like that. I'm not sure exactly how to think about it, because it's not something I ever thought about in the past. So you end up with that torsion, and that's pretty interesting, because when you have matter fields, they don't have any hypermomentum. So your mass doesn't end up with any hypermomentum. Your electromagnetic field doesn't end up with any hypermomentum. But things also have a fundamental property called spin, right?
Right.
So some things don't, but you know most things do have a spin of some value. Like an electron has a spin. So that spin will create what? Dirac fields.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though the average spin in the universe is zero, and the average spin in even a small region, right, in a cubic centimeter of space, that's still going to be zero. Even so, you're going to have fluctuations in that spin at the smallest levels, right? Because it's all associated with particles.
Yeah. So there's a probability there that they're going to be a little bit aligned at any given moment, right?
That's right. You could, at very, very small levels, it's often going to happen, right? If you're looking at a nanometer cube, a cubic nanometer worth of space, then you are not going to have enough matter in there to have the matter cancel out reliably.
Especially if you've got something like magnetism going on, right? Doesn't that require some level of alignment?
In a magnet, in a ferromagnet, you will have that kind of alignment. But you're also going to have lots of other things in that ferromagnet. In the ferromagnet, you're usually just worried about the very last electron in any particular atom. And then the rest of the electrons in atom, the rest of the electrons in your iron or your nickel or whatever, those are all going to be paired, one up, one down. So they're all, the rest of those are going to cancel in each one of those atoms. And then they're all going to be random in the nucleus. So you're going to end up with something that's only got very small fluctuations even then compared to the amount of matter that's there. But that would do something strange to this field.
Right. Yeah, any torsion would have, I guess, some kind of gravitational effect.
That's, I think, what he's saying, but I'm not completely sure. I think the weird thing is that the torsion doesn't propagate. So the matter creates the torsion. The spin could interact with the torsion, but the torsion doesn't propagate. And I'm not really sure what he means by propagate. I assume that means you don't end up with sort of torsion waves in space.
Yeah, I thought that he meant to propagate in the sense of radiation propagating, but maybe he means in terms of like an external field. I'm not sure.
I don't know enough about it. I mean, it's all very interesting the way he talks about that. There's an extra thing that happens in this metric affine theory, which is fairly interesting because he has to throw in a Lagrange multiplier. And that Lagrange multiplier ends up being the hypermomentum. That's how the hypermomentum gets into the action.
Can you explain to me what hypermomentum is? I don't think I've ever seen this term before.
I've never seen it before either. So, like I said, it's this third rank tensor that, I guess, has units of momentum that's related to changes in the action with respect to the connection. And all of those ranks in the hypermomentum tensor relate to the ranks in that connection tensor. And so something about the parallelism in this theory creates that hypermomentum. And something about the torsion creates the hypermomentum because they're sort of put together in that minimization principle. And it turns out the Lagrange multiplier, which is just a way of letting the mathematics figure out a constant for you, that Lagrange multiplier turns into basically this hypermomentum. So, and all of this will happen just because you said the connection can be asymmetric.
Yeah, it seems like it's the most interesting of all of the action equations in here, because the action seems to be independently influenced by the metric tensor, by the connection, and by the matter distribution.
Yeah, it's the most general of all of these. So it can do all sorts of strange, strange things. Exactly how meaningful it is, I don't know, because, you know, you start getting into, I have asymmetric derivatives wandering around in the world. I don't know how that works. Could work very much like things do in fluid flow, because they modify in fluid dynamics what it means to be a derivative. But I don't know enough about that either.
Well, I think that when, as the paper goes on, they say this is one of the areas that really needs a lot more research. And it seems like a lot of people are just afraid to approach it because it is enormously complicated.
Well, I think for a lot of things, especially with gravitation, people are afraid to approach it because, you know, you have something that's very, very difficult, then it's probably very, very hard to publish on top of that, and it's even harder to get funding. I think that's one of the big issues with variety and gravitational theory.
That's a shame, because superstring theory seems to get so much funding and backing and interest in everything, and it's even more complicated, and it seems like it has less... I mean, this is built directly on, is an extension as sort of general relativity. You'd figure it would have some credence, you know? People would want to know. What else can you do with that?
Superstring theory is the dominant player in that game, and if you want to get the small amount of money that they have for theoretical research, they don't have a lot of money for theoretical research, then you have to play their game, at least in the United States. I mean, you'll notice that a lot of really, really interesting gravitational stuff comes from other countries.
Yeah, even this paper is co-authored by a Canadian. Well, it'd be nice to see us casting a larger net on gravity theories, because it seems like gravity is really a crisis in modern physics and cosmology.
You would think that with dark matter, dark energy, and inflation sitting there, three things that nobody should be happy with, that, you know, you'd have more work in trying to figure out ways to explain observed phenomena without just throwing band-aids at the problem.
Right. Instead, we just triple the funding for the people looking for particles that aren't there.
Which is nice if you're somebody who's looking for a particle that may or may not be there.
Yeah, and you want to build a bigger detector. We're looking for hard data and experimental results. It seems like the theorists are kind of, they got to cling on, you know, to what little avenues they've got.
Unless the theorists are doing heavy computational research, they don't need a lot of money. But that does not turn into, it's easier for theorists to get money. It usually turns into, well, are we going to get more money for these guys to build the super cool thing that will take 2 years to build and bring, you know, 150 jobs to this community in my district? So, you know, they can just say, well, I'd like to have some summer money. And somebody might say, well, can't you think for free?
Don't you love doing this? Why not just do it for the love of it? Yeah. Did I ever send you that paper about the, there's an experimental proposal of detecting, creating a gravity field in the lab, and they proposed that you could detect it using a bouncing laser beam and an interferometer. Did I ever send you that? That seems like that would be a great experiment to build. Let's detect our first artificially made gravitational potential. Somebody had just sat down and calculated, you know, if we build this really huge magnetic apparatus, we should be able to create a strong enough effect that we could alter, I think, the polarization of a laser beam.
I don't know if you sent that to me, but I mean, it sounds like something I should try to get funding.
Yeah, you should build that. That'd be great.
Are there any other things that you wanted to talk about, the paper that interested you?
Well, yeah, there's a couple more sections. Do you want to cover that next time?
Oh, we can cover the other sections later. Is there anything you wanted to talk about with the Bronze Dickey thing? You know that Bronze, I think it's Bronze, is at Loyola.
Holy crap, I did not know that. And I think Tipler's at Tulane.
Tipler is at Tulane, yeah.
So we got some theorists in the neighborhood.
I guess we talked a little bit about it. That actually, I think I already talked about everything that I have down here that I found interesting as far as the Bronze Dickey thing. So actually, for the first three chapters, I think we hit everything that I thought was interesting.
Okay, yeah, me too.
Or I guess they're not chapters. I guess they're sections.
It feels like chapters because the paper's like 41 pages long.
And that means that a manuscript would be like 80.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's like reading a third of a book.
Except if you take out the citations and built into the text, it's probably 20.
This one isn't really bad with those. There haven't been many times when I was searching around for a sentence in the middle of the citations.
That's right.
If you don't have anything else, then I think we're okay with all of this. And we'll come back in a few weeks because we've got Christmas and stuff going on and talk about the rest of it. Does that sound all right?
That sounds great. We'll enjoy the holidays and we'll come back fresh in the new year.
Hopefully that's what it sounds like. Hopefully we're not still hungover.
We'll see. My brother's going to be here, so look out.
All right. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you, Jim.